$200 tonight. We've been stopped on under $200. Who can knock this off right and make it happen? If you're listening to Northeast Public Radio, WAMC FM 90.3 Albany.
WRUN FM 90.3 Remsen Utica.
WOSR 91.7 Middletown.
WCEL 91.9 Plattsburgh.
WCAN 93.3 Canajoharie.
WANC 103.9 Ticonderoga.
WAMQ 105.1 Great Barrington.
WAMC AM 1400 Albany.
99.3 Oneonta.
93.1 Troy.
97.3 Hello Cooperstown.
97.1 Hudson.
107.7 Newburgh.
103.9 Beacon.
107.1 Warwick.
96.5 Ellenville.
102.1 Highland.
106.9 Middletown.
90.9 Milford, Pennsylvania. And online.
And always on the internet.
At WAMC.org. Right. We need $130. We have 31 seconds. We have one phone. If that phone goes down, the clock ticks. It's about to happen. I need another phone to ring now. Please, now. We're asking you, if you're listening right now, end on a high note. Let's do this. Oh, here we go. 1-800-323-9262. 31 seconds. 30, 29, 28, $130. It's up to you. It's up to you now. 1-800, thanks to Anonymous of Munson, Massachusetts. This A American Life, 1-800-323-9262, Steve Filano.
That does it.
We did it. 11 seconds. We did it with 9 seconds to go here.
Now, that does mean, right, that does mean that we're done with the Radio Deluxe CD.
Well,
for the night. Is that right?
I suppose if there were a few stragglers and they really wanted it, we could arrange for it. However, we need to move on.
Okay.
Because we're into Living on Earth now. 1-800-323-9262.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a chance that we could even go another 1,000 here, Steve.
Oh, yeah.
But this has to be on the strength of what WAMC does with a program like Living on the Earth and the Environment. 1-800-323-9262. So here's what happens. We have a program that's on the air from 10 to 11. It's called Living on Earth. And we need you to support it. We've heard from many Radio Deluxe fans tonight. Probably not enough, but nonetheless, you were there. And you made this last goal, and we did it with just enough time to spare. And that's how we do it. That's how we roll at night. We hold it close to the wire. And we wear our passions on our sleeve. But you'd have it no other way, would you? 1-800-323-9262. So far, we're at $242,070 on this fund drive. I remember when I started, we were doing $300,000 fund drives. Now we're up to $800,000. We've grown, and the listening audience has grown and grown with us, and now we're able to raise amazing amounts of money, including at nighttime. And we're so very proud of all of our listeners and what they're able to do with us. 1-800-323-9262. So I think we still have those certificates. 1-800-323-9262 if you follow me.
Yeah.
1-800-323-9262.
Let's take a look at that.
Want to take a look at that?
Yeah, take a look at it.
All right. let me just talk to you guys privately for a second. Now, come on in closer to the radio. Gather around, will you? You know what? We've been through a lot together in 15 years. And this radio station has been on the air since 1979, its current form. And it's one thing that has always rung true, that you have been there through thick and thin, through ups and downs, through tower collapses, through tower problems that we're currently dealing with, through the formation of the Lyndon Norris Auditorium and all now the great concerts that have come, not only for you to come and appreciate here, but also to hear over the radio. That's what we have. We have this eclectic group of people that have worked to make this the greatest radio station it can be. And the only way that this radio station has survived all these many years is because of this memory, this institutional memory that we've created, this community that you've been a part of. 1-800-323-9262. And part of being a part of a community is protecting it. 1-800-323-9262. And one of the programs that we have on the air, Living on Earth, attempts to draw your eyes toward the environment. And, of course, the goal And we're seeing it now. I just saw an article in the New York Times today that the military is turning green. 1-800-323-9262. Renewable fuels and other things. The White House is about to have solar panels installed. 1-800-323-9262. And here we have this program, Living on Earth, supporting the environment. As you know, WAMC has tried to bring you that kind of programming all throughout its history. And tonight, if you're listening and it's 10 o'clock at night and you're listening and you want to do something that has impact, and we always tell you that pledging to WAMC has impact, but we have something that's even more important and has direct impact on the environment. 1-800-323-9262. Steve, why don't you tell them what we have? And this is to support Living on Earth and WAMC at the same time.
For a $100 pledge, we have here a carbon reduction certificate from the Cool Park Healthy Planet program sponsored by the Adirondack Council. Now, each of the certificates represents the permanent retirement of 3 tons worth of carbon dioxide allowances from the 10-state regional greenhouse gas initiative. It's the only government-mandated carbon dioxide reduction program in the U.S., and each certificate can be personalized with the name of the donor or anyone that the donor chooses. This could be a family member, a loved one, an organization, anything that you'd like. And we just want to note that the allowances are not offsets, such as promises to do something in compensation for carbon emissions. The real emissions reductions at real power plants from Maine to Maryland purchased at the auction.
And you know what's happening with our air that's being polluted by these Western power plants. So this is a real solution to removing this tonnage of pollution credits which would allow these companies to pollute. This does not allow them to use these credits to pollute. It really stops them from sending this stuff into the atmosphere. And for a $100 pledge, you can retire those credits right now at 1-800-323-9262. Actually helping the environment by your pledge. So you support WAMC and you retire these credits at the same time. 1-800-323-9262. We have a few of these certificates left. We've saved them for Living on Earth time. If you're a supporter of the environment, as I know our listeners are, from hydrofracking to pollution of our landfills to this current crisis of the air and the air that we have to breathe as a result of the pollution that's in it, this is something that we've chosen to do with the Adirondack Council that can help retire these credits and get this stuff out of the atmosphere. Stop it from ever getting there in the first place. And you can be a part of that. 1-800-323-9262. So, what's next, Steve?
Eric.
Well, Dave, we're still in the Living on Earth. We've got this great song coming up behind us.
Well, this is really this dream that we have.
Mm-hmm.
That when we make the call, this amazing cacophony of sound would happen. The whole room would fill with phones. That people would say, you know, we get it, guys. We're going to be there for you, and here we are. So, you know, every day we dream that this will happen. But
we hope that people will call up and pledge for Living on Earth and take home with them some of the carbon emission certificates. And if enough people do, maybe in a little bit we can give them a little segment of Living on Earth.
Yes, and I think that's probably a good idea. In fact, why don't we set a goal of...
Let's try and do it by 10:30. Get something.
I say... We play a segment for 10 minutes.
Okay.
10 and 10.
What are we going to try to get in 10 minutes?
We're going to try to get to... let's see. Can we knock that in half?
Yeah. 500, let's say, in 10
$500.
Minutes.
$500. Here we go. 9 minutes, 38 seconds, $500. A $100 pledge, you remove how much tonnage?
Three, I believe.
Three tons?
Am I right?
3 tons worth of carbon dioxide allowances. Right now, at $100 pledge, you can help safely remove that from ever being allowed in the atmosphere.
So that's five people. Five people call up, remove 3 tons of carbon from
that's
the atmosphere
15 tons.
Each. That helps us make the goal.
Carbon emissions.
We give you a segment of Living on Earth.
9 minutes.
All is right with the world.
We need five people. 1-800-323-9262. The problem is, it's not happening. So, here's what we need.
One Dorito.
This is the death of me.
We need that. What else do we need?
Pledges. Those are good. And wrong. Now, what if we did what we, our big fallback plan was, though, every time we do this?
What's that?
That we're saying too much, that we just say the phone number and pledge now. 1-800-323-9262.
Pledge now. We need $500.
1-800-323-9262.
Pledge now. 8 minutes left.
$500.
And go.
1-800-323-9262.
Pledge now.
8 minutes. 1-800-323-9262. 7 minutes, 55 seconds.
Carbon emission certificates.
$100 pledge.
1-800-323-9262.
7 minutes, 46 seconds. We need how much? $500. We need five phones to ring. At 10:10 in the evening, with this amount of opportunity before you, a chance to remove 3 tons of carbon from the atmosphere, a chance to support living on Earth, a chance to keep WAMC alive, and 7 minutes and 27 seconds, five phones? Five phones? What is a hero, Steve? 1-800-323-9262.
Someone who calls now.
Get on the phone! 1-800-323-9262. Get on my phone! 7 minutes. I just picture people going, all right, already.
Maybe they are.
I can't do it anymore, Dave and Steve. You've laid it on me already, so thick. I already gave.
Me, man.
I already gave.
Look, man.
Go to the other people. But we are going to the other people. If you gave already, you have a great conscience and you're worried and you feel like you need to help us, but you have done your part.
Then maybe you know some other people and you can call them up and be like, hey, man.
And they're going to be like, don't call me at 10:12 in the evening. No.
Oh, whatever.
You know what?
You're fine.
If you're out there and you're listening and you haven't done something, you know who you are. And we know who you are. Okay, we don't really know who you are. But we would like
to send them a tweet. Tweet them.
We'd like to think that you would be willing to get on this phone tonight and make a few more pledges. Then again, it's up to you. 6 minutes, 13 seconds. 1-800-323-9262.
Pledge now. We need $500. It's five of you. Five people who will walk away with Adirondack Council carbon reduction certificates. Removing 3 tons each from the atmosphere.
5 minutes and 55 seconds.
That's the time you have to do it in. So you need to call 1-800-323-9262 to do this.
We need
1-800-323-9262.
We still need 500?
Yes.
5 minutes and 43 seconds.
You got it.
1-800-323-9262.
Go.
And
they're off.
5 minutes and 34 seconds.
There's one.
1-800-323-9262.
Pledge now.
We're just going to keep going like this, and it'll happen. 5 minutes, 25 seconds. 1-800-323-9262.
We're looking for $500. Five of you can do it. Five of you can do it at 1-800-323-9262. Go.
You only have 5 minutes and 13 seconds to do that in. That's $500. 1-800-323-9262.
Go.
You pledge 100, you can take 3 tons of carbon out of the atmosphere through this amazing program with the Adirondack Council, support
Indeed.
Living on Earth, an environmental program, and the environment, and WAMC all at the same time. 4 minutes, 55 seconds. We need $500.
The time is now.
1-800-323-9262.
And they're off.
4 minutes, 48 seconds. We need $500.
Yes, we do.
We have not much time. 1-800-323-9262. Pledge now.
Time to pledge.
Go. Do it.
And they're going.
Do it. 1-800-323-9262. 4 minutes, 31 seconds. 1-800-323-9262.
We need $500. Five of you can do this. We need five people who will call up. Pledge 100 for these carbon reduction certificates. That gets us to our goal.
Do it.
1-800.
That's right.
323-9262.
Do it.
411. $500. 1-800-323-9262.
Do it.
That's what you have to do.
Time is ticking away.
4 minutes. 4 minutes.
We're running out.
4 minutes. We have 4 minutes. 3 minutes, 53 seconds, actually. 1-800-323-9262.
Pledge now.
1-800-323-9262.
We need five of you to pledge.
3 minutes, 41 seconds.
Time is running out.
We need you now. $500.
1-800-323-9262. And go.
3 minutes, 30 seconds.
Coming up against it. We're getting into the 2 minute range.
But we have three phones up. That could be $500 right there. 1-800-323-9262. 3 minutes, 16. Everything okay? 1-800.
I hope so. 323-9262.
3 minutes. I am up with a million excuses.
Hopefully it doesn't take more than 3 minutes.
3 minutes. Don't find an excuse. Find a reason to give now. $500. 2 minutes, 55 seconds. You don't think it's going to happen, do you? But there's pledges coming in here.
I do
people.
Think it's
1-800-323-9262. Pledge now.
So much more than I get.
I just haven't met you yet. Thanks to Charles Wilkinson, who we just met from Longmeadow, Massachusetts. Good luck. Well, we're going to make it with people like you. $400 now. 2 minutes and 30 seconds. We have two more pledges that are going to come up here. This could be it. You'll be missing a very amazing accomplishment if you don't get on that phone right now. 2 minutes and 20 seconds. 1-800-323-9262. Pledge now. 1-800-323-9262. 2 minutes and 10 seconds. 1-800-323-9262. $300 now. Thanks to Anonymous. Happy that we are doing good work. Here it comes. This could be the final push. 1 minute 59 seconds. You can make it happen now. We need $200. 1 minute and 54 seconds. You didn't think we could do it, but we can. 300, right? 1-800-323-9262, 1:46. But we have a pledge on the table that's going to be coming any minute. We have another call, and we can do this. Come on now, 1:37 to go. 1-800-323-9262. Focus in now. If you're a guardian angel, if you can help us make this little bit more. We've got 1:26. We need three phones to ring. Well, two phones to ring because we have one that's already going. In fact, we can do this. We can really do this. 1 minute and 17 seconds. 1-800-323-9262. Steve, 1 minute, 12 seconds. We can do it. We can do it. 1-800-323-9262. 1 minute to go. 1 minute to go. 1-800-323-9262. 1 minute now. Focus in. We can make this happen. It's going to happen. I can certainly feel that the possibility is here. You know, when you have that last moment of positivity and you say, this could really happen. 1-800-323-9262. Well, we're on the cusp now. We're on the cusp. I'm telling you right now, when this pledge form comes up here, you're going to be surprised. 1-800-323-9262. I haven't seen it yet, but I have this feeling. I have a feeling that something good is about to happen. Thank you, thank you. Thank you to Anonymous of Del Mar, New York. Enjoy all. Good luck. Carbon 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-9262. We need two people now. We have one phone. Certainly we need one. But we need $200. And we have one phone, one pledge going now. So now we're down to it. Now it really comes down to, will you do it or not? 1-800-323-9262. If you pledge now, you support the environment. You get a carbon reduction certificate. Take 3 tons of carbon out of the atmosphere. All in one fell swoop, you can help us make this goal and do it right tonight. 1-800-323-9262. We just haven't met you yet. So you just have to get on that phone and say hi. I'm a new member of WAMC, and I'm going to strengthen my pledge. I'm going to put you over the top tonight, guys. 1-800-323-9262. We have one volunteer taking a pledge. How are we doing over there? We still got that one phone rolling there,
Two
Steve?
Phones.
Two phones now?
That's right.
Where's the second
directly
phone?
Directly behind you.
There's one.
There you go.
Where's the other one?
Went down.
No phones. Just one. 1-800-323-9262. There's somebody out there that can end this right now. Now, will you be the champion for us? Will you be our chariot? Will you take us, 1-800-323-9262, over the top? You will do that. You say to yourself, now, how can I do something like that? Well, it's very simple. We need $200. We have a minute and 4 seconds on the clock. We have one phone and one volunteer taking a pledge. That could be for 100. That could be for 150. Certainly one more could end it right now. Mm-hmm. You hear this music? This should be inspiring because it should say to you, possibilities are endless in life. With enough good people doing something, we cannot fail. And we have these certificates, a whole sheet of these certificates right now that could reduce tons of carbon from the atmosphere. We're asking you to give $100 to support it. We've knocked out three goals at once. The environment, living on Earth, WAMC, all at the same time. And the point being that we need to make this goal. And we will not be moved until we do. And you will be the ones to help us do it. 1-800-323-9262. And if you're just tuning in and you're saying, what is this? It's a public radio fund drive. And if you've never heard anything like it, stick around. 1-800-323-9262. Because following the money raising comes a programming that you haven't experienced before. And if you've never heard us, you ought to stick around for a while and find out what we're all about. And tonight, if you know what we're about and you want to show people who are listening for the first time what we're about, then you will be in the spirit of community on that phone right now at 1-800-323-9262. Because I guarantee you, people are checking in on the radio and they're wondering what this is. And if they don't hear excitement, if they don't hear phones ringing, if they don't hear the people supporting us, what's their incentive but to turn the channel and move on and say, this isn't worth anything, not worth our time, certainly not worth a pledge. But we know you know different. And we know you'll make it happen. And we're waiting. We're waiting on this pledge, which quite frankly, must be a very large amount because it's taking an awfully long time. I think that was it. 1-800-323-9262. I think the phone just went down, Steve.
You are correct, Dave.
And here we go. 1 minute and 4 seconds. So 1 minute and 3 seconds. 1 minute and 2 seconds. This is what it is. This is what it's all about. 1-800-323-9262. Thanks to Christina of Hudson, New York. I only pledge for Living on Earth. I wish it were on an hour earlier. It's such a good program on so many levels. 1-800-323-9262. We need $180. That's what we need. We need $180. That's what we need. Steve, we need $180.
We do. We still have these Adirondack Council carbon emission reduction certificates.
Do we?
Table here. Yes.
Oh, I thought they all went.
No.
1-800-323-9260. Really?
As a matter of fact, yes.
I hadn't noticed that. Seemed like they were flying right out of the place. Not. We need $180. That's what we need. In order to stay with the theme of the song, which would be staying alive, we'd actually have to stay alive. To stay alive, we'd have to actually make the $180. Now, we're about to find out how close we've gotten, because the clock has just run out on that. And, well, we're slightly short. Thanks to Anonymous of Tyringham, Massachusetts. Missed the regular schedule. Happy to help. We need $120. $120. That's what we need. That's what we need.
One person can do this. Easily. That's one carbon emission certificate. You might get a mystery pledge.
Ooh, that is almost a guarantee.
You probably will.
There's a lot
That's
of things.
Your thing.
Now, I don't know if you didn't hear this before. One person perhaps could have won a yodeling pickle. That's worth a $60, $100 pledge right there.
Why don't you get a little taste of that? What does it sound like? Hey, get that right up there.
That's lovely.
That's one way to put it.
That's a yodeling pickle.
That's lovely.
Anybody, you know anybody that has a yodeling pickle?
No. No. For good reason.
1-800-323-9262.
But you might get something else. Maybe you get the yodeling pickle. Maybe you'll get something else out of it. There's a lot of stuff in there.
You're lucky.
And that's not the only mystery bag or the mystery box either. There are more of them.
You're lucky if you get
the third floor.
You're lucky if you get the yodeling pickle.
Is that so?
Oh.
Well, you're closer to this than I am, I think. You know more about it. Were you in the meetings that I didn't get to go to?
Yeah.
On the mystery box?
Uh-huh.
Special meetings held on there?
I was.
Okay.
Special.
Right. Yeah, special.
Special
yeah.
meetings.
Special top secret security clearance meetings.
The meeting.
On the third floor.
The minutes are on the internet.
No, they're not.
No, they're not. You're
classified.
Right. They're classified. Yeah. We keep those in secret location. Secretly arrived at. All right, now. Let's focus. We need $120. Let's do this so we can get out of here. 1-800-32. That's a good reason.
Sure.
The volunteers are just like, you know, come on. I could have been home sleeping by now. I'll give the $120. Forget them. No, we don't do it that way. Even though they try to shove money at us. And that's, you know, so they don't want us to be embarrassed, and I appreciate that. But we're willing to put ourselves out there and be red-faced over this. I don't want to be, but we're willing to do it. Because that's the kind of night crew people we are. We're willing to crash and burn just...
And I think we've done it a couple times already.
Nah.
But that's okay.
Nah, because how much have we raised tonight so far, Steve?
Let's see.
Oh, now there's got to be more number calculations?
Yeah, the other figure's old. The other figure's maybe half.
You
old.
And your darn math.
Let's see, what are we at?
1-800-323-9262. What do we need? We need $120. Now, come on.
All right, so, hey, we're almost, we're closing in. 9,266. It's not bad.
That's incredible. Thank you, all of you that have helped us raise
$9,200
tonight.
We only had 400 in challenge money at the beginning, too. Of the evening, so yeah, that's not anything to sneeze at.
No.
We made ten last night, 10,000, but we had about $1,000 in challenge money.
Now, what's our segments? What's our segments look like here, Steve? Because we could combine a couple and do a last push here and see if we can get this last $120. So let's see. Okay, so this is how much time we would have on these two. So we got to get to that amount of time left. So can you calculate that from that? If we do segment four and five, it comes out to 21:44. We would need 21:44 to get those in. So where would that? Where would we have to end? So that's how many? 10 minutes to go. 1-800-323-9262. This is our last push of the evening, and then you're going to get living on Earth. It's that simple. You're going to get your
$120.
We need $120. Can you give us $120 in 9:47? That's it. That's all we're going to have for tonight. That's it. That's right. We're going to blast into outer space this way. You're going to help us do it. That's right.
We're going to leave Earth.
We're leaving Earth to make this happen. Apparently, the only place...
Leaving Earth, we're living on Earth.
In order to live on Earth, we have to leave Earth to do it. 1-800-323-9262. We are on Dantooine right now. The Rebel Force...
We'll be going to Hoth.
...is with us. Yes? That's right.
Exactly.
That's right, Chewie. Don't worry about it. We'll be with us in a second. 1-800-323-9262. Come on now. I lost our two. 9 minutes. 9 minutes, we need $120. Who will call up and give us something now? Except for grief. We don't need grief.
But we'll accept that if it comes with $120.
But we'll accept any comment you want to make with a dollar amount. Yeah, if you want to pledge $120 and give us a what for, we're happy for that.
That's fine.
We'll read it out over the air. Anything you like. But what we're going to need in 8 minutes and 35 seconds is $120. If we can't do that, we can't wait longer. I'm sorry about that. There it is, right there. That's the call. This is the one we've been waiting for, Steve. Sit back and let it flow in. Here we go. And this is the part where it's a little scary. See, this is the part where you know something bad's going to happen. This music...
The rebel base will be in firing range. within 8 minutes and 2 seconds.
Unless we get $120.
Use the Force, Steve and Dave.
Dial 1-800-323-9262.
Let's pull this thing, kid, and get out of here! It's like shooting wombats back home. 1-800-323-9262. That's what he said.
Is that what he said?
7 minutes and 33 seconds. I just impacted on the surface. The rebel base will be in firing range in 7 minutes and 25 seconds.
Or just $120.
$120 can save the universe. 1-800-323-9262.
If we can't get the 120, then the Empire wins. All right? The Empire wins.
Steve, I am your father.
Waiting for $120.
1-800-323-9262.
6 minutes and 50 seconds remaining.
Okay. What's it going to be?
Do not stop time on this one. It's now or never.
The Rebel Base.
We still have the carbon emission reduction certificates for a $100 pledge. You can still get those. But in 6 minutes, 32 seconds, that's it for tonight.
$120 will defeat the Death Star. 6 minutes and 28 seconds. Goodness gracious. For everybody. For all of the great characters of WAMC. From the...
And there are many.
From the Rebels to the... Ewoks.
The old Rebels. And just keep on rebelling.
Yep. There are people on both sides of the Force.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. And we've lost some good people. Some good pets. 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC. 5 minutes and 52 seconds. That's what we need. $120. And what's happening right now?
The Rebel base will be within firing range in 5 minutes
40
and
seconds.
40 seconds.
And we're done. We're toast. They can blow up a whole planet. You don't think they can blow up a radio
station?
They've
done it.
Oh, my goodness. We can't have this.
You got that right.
This is not something that Lucas wrote into the script. 1-800-323-9262. Thanks to Anonymous of Shelburne Falls, probably. Good night and good luck. Vote for Radio Deluxe. 1-800-323-9262. Good night and good luck it is. That's true. Listen now, we need $20. 5 minutes.
The Rebel base will be in firing range in 5 minutes.
Princess Leia, what will we do? 1-800-323-9262. Come on, kid, blow this thing and let us go home.
4 minutes and 40 seconds.
4 minutes and 44 seconds. You know you can't resist.
1-800-323-9262.
Some reason the Force is calling them to the phones. 1-800-323-9262. 4 minutes and 21 seconds, Stephen. That's what we have. There is no more time. Will you do it now?
Four minutes, 9 seconds.
4 minutes.
1-800-323-9262. It's just that simple.
3 minutes, 50 seconds now.
What's that, R2?
No turning back.
R2, what's that? Help us, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're our only hope.
1-800-323-9260.
There's no need to fear.
Oh, my.
Underdog is here.
Could it be?
You can do it for underdog, can't you?
Wow. 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 When criminals in this world appear and break the laws that they should fear, and frighten all who see or hear the cry goes up both far and near for WAMC.
What? WAMC? It's WAMC. I said WAMC.
Speed of lightning, roar of thunder, fighting all who rob or plunder.
Underdog.
WAMC.
WMC is the underdog.
The underdog.
Ooh, wah, ooh, wah, ooh, wah, ooh, wah, ooh, wah, ooh.
In this world, the headlines read, and Moses' hearts are filled with greed. Robin steal from those who need. Right this wrong with blinding speak of WAFC.
120.
WAFC
is the underdog.
Speed of lightning, roar of thunder, fighting all who rob or plunder. WAFC.
WAFC is the underdog.
Underdog.
2 minutes, 27 seconds left. Let's thank
thanks
people.
To Joanne Welch of Fort Edward, New York, who is our savior, who took the $120 into herself and said, you know what, guys?
Let's do it.
This is for you. This is for the rebels to defeat the Death Star. 2 minutes and 11 seconds, and the sun is going to rise again. I can feel it in my bones. Because the positive energy and the love that comes from these listeners during the nighttime when we're told you're not there is always proven wrong. And here comes the sun.
Here comes the sun, I say.
It's all right. 1 minute and 49 seconds. That's right. You can give all you want in that time frame. And you can even give into the night. Heather is here, 1-800-323-9262.
Extension zero.
Thanks to Karen Roth of Albany, New York, to support Light Side of Force, only radio station I listen to. That's what we want to hear. 1-800-323-9262. It's all right.
We got a minute 25 left.
1-800.
We need to hear from you.
323-9262. We thank everybody who's checked in with us tonight and given for the night crew. You know, it's very special, our time together. It's a limited amount of time. It's a time that we have to do as much as we possibly can to help end this fun drive earlier and earlier. And if we can knock a whole day off the fun drive, that means a whole day of your programming back before and when you want it. 57 seconds before we go to Living on Earth, and you can still give to this radio station, 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC. Believe it or not, we're $230 away from $243,000. Thanks to James Constant, who is with us constantly in Saugerties, New York. I'm pledging to keep us away from the dark side. 1-800-323-9262. I love it. 30 seconds. 30 seconds. You are not the dark side. You are the light. You've always been that for us. And together, we can't help but keep those candles lit, can we? It's how we do this. It's how we roll. We love you all. 15 seconds to go. Steve and Dave and the volunteers. You left us close to 243,000 thanks to Anonymous of Poughkeepsie. Thanks to Anonymous of North Bennington. Get lots of my news Saturday, Sunday mornings. Great fan of the station. We love you. See you soon.
We're back with a special edition of Living on Earth. I'm Jeff Young. You might call it a money meltdown. For decades, the federal government promised to permanently bury high-level nuclear waste in the Yucca Mountain repository in Nevada. And utility consumers paid the government billions of dollars to do that. But the Obama administration wants to pull the plug on Yucca Mountain, while at the same time promising $54 billion in federal loan guarantees to build new reactors. That means nuclear utility companies have to continue to store the spent fuel rods on site, often in pools of water and increasingly in special dry casks. Living on Earth's senior correspondent Bruce Gellerman has been following the flow of the waste and following the money. His story starts in Haddam, Connecticut.
Haddam, Connecticut is quintessential old New England, a collection of quaint villages founded 350 years ago. Today, it's a bedroom community for New Haven and nearby Hartford. Elizabeth Molloy was born and raised in the historic town.
Well, we're in Haddam Meadows State Park right now, and you can see what attracted the first settlers to Haddam. I mean, that this beautiful open space floodplain here that provided, you know, great areas to grow hay and crops and things like that, as well as you're right on the Connecticut River here.
At Haddam Neck, where the Connecticut converges with the Salmon River, there are sites from the town's prehistoric past, homes from its rich colonial heritage, and remnants of a nuclear power plant whose final chapter has yet to be written. Elizabeth Molloy is executive director of the Haddam Historical Society. She's keeper of records and preserver of memories, like this one circa 1966, when this small town entered the atomic era, piece by piece.
I was probably in third or fourth grade, and I can remember the day they brought the turbine in. They actually closed school, and the whole school walked down the hill, and we sat there and we watched it drive down the road because it was a huge, huge ordeal. And we got out of classes for the afternoon, and I can remember the turbine being brought in.
Then came the even larger nuclear reactor, and later the shipments of the 1,019 enriched uranium fuel rods that would power the plant. In the basement of the Historic Society, Elizabeth Molloy pulls out plastic toy windmills, a comic book, and a wood ruler, freebies students got on field trips to the Connecticut Yankee nuclear power plant, and on a dusty shelf, old metal canisters.
And the other thing we got were these movies. January 12, 1966, produced for Connecticut Yankee Atomic Power Plant. I love the title, The Atom, A-T-O-M, and Eve. The other movie we have is called The Mighty Atom, starring Reddy Kilowatt. And he was a little kilowatt cartoon character. And the atom would come to life and tell us all the wonderful attributes of nuclear power.
I wash and dry your clothes, play your radios, I can heat your coffee pot. I am always there with lots of power to spare, cause I'm ready, kilowatt. Remember, just plug in. I'm ready.
It was interesting. I think probably every middle school in Lower Connecticut probably went there at one time or another.
But today, the Connecticut Yankee site is off limits. It's fenced off and guarded 24/7. In 1996, after the reactor core lost cooling water, the plant was shut down for good, just 28 years into its 40-year license to operate. It took a decade to decontaminate the area. The discovery of radioactivity underneath the plant doubled the cost to decommission the site, soil, and surroundings. Yankee utility ratepayers footed the $870 million bill.
And directly across the way here, you can see the parking lot of Connecticut Yankee. And you can see the old wires that would come down the dome. And the full facility was located directly straight ahead where those wires are, where that tower is.
So the plant was
right here, right on the river. Couldn't miss it. You could not miss it. I've actually flown in planes over Connecticut, and that was how I could tell where I lived, because we'd look down and look for the dome. And now it's completely gone. There's not a building left.
What does remain of what was once the Connecticut Yankee Nuclear Power Plant is hidden from view in 43 huge dry storage casks lined up in rows, like a modern Stonehenge. The casks, 20 feet high and 11 feet in diameter, are made of reinforced concrete and stainless steel. Each weighs 100 tons. They contain all of the spent nuclear fuel assembly rods ever used at the plant. Historian Elizabeth Molloy says in 1987, the federal government promised Haddam it would haul the dry casks away to a permanent repository in Nevada.
When this storage facility was built, we were told that it would remain there until Yucca Mountain opened, which, if you talk to one person, it was going to be a matter of a few years. If you talk to other people, it might be a decade or so. And if you were to talk to probably realists, it was never going to happen.
And so far, it hasn't. There are more than 60 dry-cast stone hinges containing high-level commercial nuclear power waste in 33 states. When Nevada said, "Not in my backyard," communities like Haddam, Connecticut, wound up keeping the radioactive waste in theirs. Technically, the cast sites are called independent spent fuel storage installations. At some, the nuclear plants are long gone and decommissioned, but the radioactive waste they produce, some with half-lives in the tens of thousands of years, remain orphaned in what was supposed to be interim storage.
If you had a question for the owners of Connecticut Yankee, what would you ask them now in terms of the waste?
Well, I think I would ask them what the plan is for the dry cast storage. I mean, how long is it going to be there? And they'll probably tell me they don't know. It's in the federal government's hands. It's always passing the buck, I think, to somebody else.
But you paid the bucks.
I do pay the bucks, but I'm just one person.
Today, we all pay to temporarily store commercial nuclear power waste. But it wasn't supposed to be that way. Connecticut Yankee produced 110 billion kilowatt hours of electricity. Under the terms of the Federal Nuclear Waste Fund established in 1983, consumers of the energy paid a tenth of a cent per kilowatt hour for the removal and permanent storage of the nuclear waste. Bob Capstick, a spokesman for the Connecticut Yankee, says the pennies have added up.
Right now, I believe they collect somewhere on the order of $750 to $800 million a year from the operating plants.
And that doesn't include interest. Over the years, the Federal Nuclear Waste Fund has collected more than $30 billion. About $10 billion went to study Yucca Mountain. The rest went into the government coffers and now exists as an IOU to be reimbursed by future taxpayers. Because Connecticut Yankee was decommissioned, it no longer pays into the Federal Waste Fund. Today, the company only exists to maintain and monitor the dry cast storage installation. It costs $8 million a year, and Bob Capstick says that money has to come from someplace, and that someplace is, once again, ratepayers.
In effect, they've kind of been forced to pay twice. Because of the failure of the federal government to come and take the fuel in 1998 to begin removing it from the site, we had to build this dry cast storage facility, and each year that we continue to have to safely protect and monitor the spent fuel for the federal government, it costs the ratepayers money as well. And so we've gone into court, and we've sued the federal government for its failure to meet its obligation.
So far, Yankee has been awarded $140 million in damages and has more suits pending. So do other nuclear energy companies. In fact, there have been 60 suits against the federal government for failing to take spent fuel as required by law. Power plant operators have won all of them. $7 billion has been paid out, and that money comes from not the Nuclear Waste Fund, collected from ratepayers, but the Federal Treasury, taxpayers. And now Steve Kraft from the Nuclear Energy Institute says enough is enough. The trade group wants the Department of Energy to stop collecting the tenth of a penny per kilowatt hour that continues to flow into the Nuclear Waste Fund.
If things continue the way they are, the ratepayer will continue to pay and get no services because they're shutting down the Yucca Mountain project, which was the only thing that program was currently paying for.
And a growing number of state officials agree with the Nuclear Energy Institute.
We have the federal government's waste, and the federal government has our money.
That's Greg White. He sits on Michigan's Public Service Commission.
In my view, this is more than just a legal obligation. This is, in fact, a moral obligation. At some point in time, the customers of the nuclear utilities in this country need to get some kind of a return.
White wants the Department of Energy to live up to the contracts it signed 27 years ago and haul away what now amounts to more than half a century of nuclear waste. The Department of Energy wouldn't provide an official to comment for this story, but the Obama administration has put together a Blue Ribbon Commission to study the waste issue. Their report is due in 2 years. In the meantime, the nation's 104 operating nuclear power plants continue to produce 4.5 million pounds of high-level radioactive waste a year. And in scores of places, like along the shore of Haddam, Connecticut, behind high-security fences and sensors, huge storage casks made of cement and stainless steel stand, silent, unseen, and largely out of mind. Testimony to a nuclear era long gone, but by no means over. For Living on Earth, I'm Bruce Gellman.
Hi, this is Jeff Young. Here at Living on Earth, we talk to a lot of scientists and policymakers, experts on environmental issues. And one of the things we hear a lot from them is that we are in a decisive period for our planet. Choices we're making now could set the course for decades to come. When I hear that, I'm reminded that it is more important than ever to be covering these issues. There's so much happening right now on the environmental front. Stories that are meaningful, fascinating, sometimes tough, sometimes fun. We want to keep bringing you these stories. To do that, we need you to make a decision. We need you to support this public radio station. You're listening to a special edition of Living on Earth. I'm Jeff Young. Coming up, a movie maker takes on climate change. But first, this note on emerging science from Amanda Martinez.
South American potato farmers may soon be able to double their yields. And all it took was a closer look at their biggest nemesis, the Guatemalan potato moth. A potato infested with moth larvae is not a pretty sight. The tiny, rust-colored caterpillars burrow their way through the tuber's flesh, leaving a trail of brown rot in their wake. But while the infested spud's fate may be sealed, other uninfected potatoes on the same plant appear to grow much larger. Scientists at Cornell University believe the source of these super spuds is the larvae's saliva. Compounds in the saliva are thought to kick the plant's photosynthesis into overdrive. The reason, researchers believe, is damage control. The infected plant sucks in additional carbon from the air, which causes it to produce more starch and bigger spuds. This, in turn, makes up for those tubers lost to the caterpillar's voracious appetite. With an increase in yield of up to 2.5 times, depending on how much of the plant is affected, farmers' hopes are up. If the tuber-clumping compound can be isolated, farmers may soon be able to turn the potato moth pest from a bane into a boon. And that's this week's Note on Emerging Science. I'm Amanda Martinez.
Now, sure, you saw Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth, but did you know Hollywood was already warning us about climate change almost 50 years before that?
Due to our release through factories and automobiles every year of more than 6 billion tons of carbon dioxide, which helps air absorb heat from the sun, our atmosphere seems to be getting warmer.
This is bad.
Well, it's been calculated a few degrees rise in the Earth's temperature would melt the polar ice caps.
That film, The Unchained Goddess, was released in 1958, and it was produced by a Hollywood legend, Frank Capra, the man who gave us It's a Wonderful Life. A clip from Capra's remarkable climate change film has been making the rounds on the internet. We asked Capra biographer Joseph McBride how Capra got involved in climate science, and it's an interesting story. Mr. McBride, welcome to Living on Earth.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Now, you wrote a book where you had extensive access to Frank Capra. What's behind this, I've got to say, eerily prescient film, The Unchained Goddess, about climate change?
Well, Capra was, he had a very good scientific training and wanted to be a chemical engineer originally, and went to what is now Caltech. It was then called Troop Institute of Technology in Pasadena. But he ran into some academic problems and shifted his focus to motion pictures. But he always had a fascination with science and kept up with the field and told me late in life that he maybe wished he had stayed in that field.
So Frank Capra, Hollywood legend, was really a frustrated scientist.
Yeah, I think so. He was also kind of a frustrated educator. In the 1950s, his career as a feature film director foundered partly due to the Blacklist era. He was under suspicion because his films had been sort of liberal and had social criticism. So he retired to his ranch in Fallbrook, California, and was lured back by AT&T to make science films for children, played first on television, then distributed to schools. And he had a lot of input from important scientists in these films. So they're smart and they hold up well scientifically.
Now, in The Unchained Goddess, it's remarkable that there's this animation that shows South Florida underwater. Little boats going in the water and the buildings under the water there.
Tourists in glass-bottom boats would be viewing the drowned towers of Miami through 150 feet of tropical water.
It's a lot of fun, and it just seems so far ahead of its time. It really kind of blows your mind when you think this was made in 1958.
Well, one of the ironies is that Capra was a Republican, and a lot of people think mistakenly that he was a liberal because his films are somewhat liberal in their orientation to some extent. But he was a lifelong conservative, and that doesn't stop him from being a good scientist and believing in climate change. Today, I think there's this dichotomy between, you know, if you're conservative, you're supposed to be antithetical to understanding climate change, which doesn't make any sense. So you could say it's strange bedfellows, Frank Capra and Al Gore, but they're more alike than Capra would probably like to admit.
Extremely dangerous questions. Even now, man may be unwittingly changing the world's climate through the waste products of his civilization, not only dealing with forces of a far greater variety than even the atomic physicist encounters, but with life itself.
Since he knew science, unlike most filmmakers, he understood deeper truths and future concerns. as far back as 1938 in his Oscar-winning film You Can't Take It With You, Jimmy Stewart talks about solar energy, which is kind of astounding when you see that in 1938. And so Our Mr. Sun is an early film advocating solar energy in 1956.
You mean the solar battery?
Yeah. The recipe for this solar wafer sounds just like a vacation. Just sand and sunshine. Expose wafer to sunlight. Presto! The motor starts running with the efficiency of an automobile. And nothing is used up but the sunshine, which is free.
Ain't that something?
Well, I'll be darned.
So it filled the hole of the fact that he was creatively frustrated in the 50s when he was sort of a self-exile from Hollywood. It was a pleasure to be away from political pressure of making films about important big issues. These were not considered important big issues at the time. Ironically, now they are.
So what do you think Frank Capra might do in terms of the current climate change debate if he were with us today?
Well, I'm afraid, since I know his M.O., that he would probably try to disassociate himself from The Unchained Goddess because he'd be on the wrong side of the political spectrum. I'm saying that because, for example, during the Vietnam War, Capra gave a talk at a college in which he sort of disowned Mr. Smith Goes to Washington because it was highly critical of the American political system, which I think is kind of sad that he would sort of run away from the implications of his own films. But he was very traumatized by, first, the reaction against Mr. Smith from some right-wing pundits and politicians, and then the post-war backlash against liberal filmmaking or left-wing filmmaking. So I think he'd be uncomfortable about being considered a man crying out in the wilderness that climate change is a problem.
Now, you got a lot of time to talk with him, and it sounds like pretty personal conversations. What did he tell you about his early desire to follow science?
Well, I had a lot of very revealing conversations with him. He was very interesting to talk to, and we had a very good discussion, which I used to end my book, Frank Capra, The Catastrophe of Success, because I think it was so revealing. If you want me to, I could read that discussion.
Yeah, let's hear that.
Well, I asked him if he thought he had made the right choice to forsake his scientific ambitions for motion pictures, and he said, not particularly. So I said, well, you think you would have been happier in science? He said, yes. And I said, why? He said, I would have done more. And I said, where do you think you would have ended up? He said, with Dr. Edwin Hubble, as an astronomer. I could study the stars and the planets forever. I always wanted to know why. Then why didn't you do it? What changed your mind? Pictures changed my mind. I was too far along in the movie business. But when I go to Caltech now and I hear about things I'm not familiar with, like black holes, damn, I get mad. How the hell I ever refused that, I don't know. Whatever made me refuse it. So I think he really believed that scientists were doing more important things than motion picture directors.
You know, I want to go back to the 1938 film, You Can't Take It With You, and this moment where Jimmy Stewart's character is talking about his enthusiasm for solar power. Let's hear just a bit of that.
I remember in college, another guy and I had an idea that we wanted to find out what made the grass grow green. Because there's a tiny little engine in the green of this grass and in the green of the trees that has the mysterious gift of being able to take energy from the rays of the sun and store it up. Well, we thought if we could find the secret of all those millions of little engines in this green stuff, we can make big ones. And then we could take all the power we could ever need right from the sun's rays, you see?
It's a fantastically well-acted scene. It goes on for actually 4.5 minutes in one shot. So it's very intimate, and you get a real sense of the actors. And Capra and Robert Riskin, the screenwriter, had made a lot of changes in the play that they adapted there, You Can't Take It With You. And they added that scene, and that was obviously very personal to Capra. Robert Riskin didn't have a scientific background, so I think we could safely ascribe that to Capra. And Jimmy Stewart is giving his talk about the potential of solar energy, and then he expresses regret that he didn't pursue it. So that definitely comes from Capra's heart as well.
Joseph McBride is an associate professor of cinema at San Francisco State University and author of Frank Capra, The Catastrophe of Success. Thanks very much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Well, that was such a fun piece to do. I had no idea film legend Frank Capra was a frustrated scientist. Hi there, I'm Jeff Young. I know a lot of our Living on Earth listeners have a strong interest in science, either as a career or just something to feed their curiosity. And that's why we devote so much energy to bringing you conversations with scientists at the cutting edge, expanding our understanding of the natural world and our place in it. We can't do that without you. Here's your chance to play a starring role. Pick up the phone and call with your pledge of support for this station. Here's the number, and thanks.
This is Northeast Public Radio, WAMC-FM 90.3 Albany, WRUN-FM 90.3 Remsen Utica, WAMK 90.9 Kingston, WOSR 91.7 Middletown, WCEL 91.9 Plattsburgh, WCAN 93.3 Canajoharie, WANC 103.9 Ticonderoga, WAMQ 105.1 Great Barrington, WAMC-AM 1400 Albany, and online at WAMC.org.
Hello, I'm Margot Kelly.
Good evening, I'm Mary Ambrose. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
Seeing Red, Hungary declares a state of emergency after a dam bursts and floods villages with toxic crimson sludge.
Crime pays and pays and pays. A French trader's prison sentence is the least of his problem. A judge's insistence that he pay back billions of euros is the most.
Assault of the Earth, a pioneering climate change scientist, says a new tar sands project shouldn't go ahead as planned.
Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. But freedom has caused Jonathan Franzen to lose a number of things, including his glasses.
Recessive forehead, progressive heart. Neanderthals certainly looked a little rough, but they were actually surprisingly tender.
And not every clown has a silver lining. A British theme park introduces an evil clown-themed attraction, which has their non-evil, real-life counterparts pouring out of tiny little cars in protest. As It Happens, the Tuesday edition radio that assumes that if the clowns have a lawyer, she's working pro bozo. Being flooded is bad. Being flooded with toxic red sludge is much worse. People in villages in western Hungary are currently being inundated by poisonous muck. It started yesterday after weeks of heavy rain when chemical waste burst through a reservoir dam. The sludge, which is a byproduct in the production of aluminum, contains a highly corrosive material. Attila Nikos is an official with Hungary's National Directorate General for Disaster Management. We spoke to him earlier today when he was driving back from the village of Kolontár, which was one of the towns most affected by the toxic waste.
Dr. Nikos, you were in Kolontár today. What kind of damage did you see in the village?
The first thing that you see when you go into the village is that the bottom of the house is painted red. But this was caused by this industrial accident, of course. The flood, this mud flood, I would say, it's over, and we are getting back to normalcy again.
Now, we understand that four people have died, more are missing, and 100 or so have been treated for injuries. What does this red chemical mud do to people?
Well, actually, if it is contaminating your skin, you touch it with your hand, then you get burned. Imagine that the pH factor, for example, in a normal shampoo that you use in your bath is 7, and the pH factor of this muddy water was 13. So it's burning. Actually, you get burned. This is causing a surface injury on your skin. You have to wash it very carefully with a lot of water. And actually, the deaths are caused because of drowning into this muddy water.
And can you give us a sense of how much toxic mud actually was released from this reservoir?
after the first estimations, we estimated to 600,000-700,000 cubic meter that actually went off after the rupture of the dike.
And where is it headed? It's in a river now, but where might it be going?
After the rupture, it spread out on a territory near Kolontar to arable land. The most of it luckily went to an arable land, and is 3 hectares there, and 7 hectares downstream more in Devecher. In Kolontar, for example, only two streets, houses in two streets were touched because that mud stream just ran across the village. Devecher was more heavily struck because there were 19 streets that were actually inundated by this very thick flash alkali mud flood.
Now, I understand some did get into the local river, and there were some concerns that it might flow into the Danube. What is happening in that regard?
In that regard, the creek Torna actually is going into the river Marcal, and Marcal going to the river Danube. And the Hungarian CBRN hazmat teams, that's how we call it technically, those who actually have got a kind of a mobile laboratory that work on the rivers. There were six of them working on the site, and they measured the level of contamination in the river, but none of the measurements were over the health safety standards. And this is, I think, is also due to the decontamination measures that we have done. For example, that there were 1,000 tons of calcium sulfate, people know as in gypsum or gips, that was poured into the river, and then this is stopping the alkali effect and getting pH factor back to normal.
So you're pouring plaster into the river to try and stop the effect of the toxicity?
Yes, and quite effectively. Because downstream, when we measure it, it's not getting over the health standards.
Now the sludge is a waste byproduct of the alumina production. Were there any concerns about the way this waste was stored before today?
Actually, this plant was not built like yesterday, and it was running for decades without any accident. And this was a sudden event, and still the cause of it, what actually happened, is under investigation.
And what's been the reaction of people living in this area?
Well, in such situations, people just can adapt temporarily to this inconvenience because 300 people had to leave their houses, and for tonight, some of them have already returned. It's mainly the farmers who had their animals, for example, in the area. But most of them still had to stay outside from the village, and we are working on the contamination of the area that they could get back home as soon as possible and safe.
Has this kind of disaster ever happened before at this factory or other ones in your country?
In Hungary, no. This is the first time that we are facing such an accident and an alkali mud is by a dike rupture, is getting out of its depot.
Okay, Dr. Nikos, thank you very much for telling us about this.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Attila Nikos is an official with Hungary's National Directorate General for Disaster Management. We reached him after a trip to see Kolontar, one of the towns that was worst hit by the toxic red sludge. Is it a responsible new energy project or another fine mess? Today, in Alberta, a federal-provincial panel reconvened to address the sustainability of a new tar sands bitumen extraction project. It's called the Joslin North mine project. If approved, it would be operated by French-based oil producer Total EP. One of those addressing the panel is James Hansen. He's the director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, but is perhaps best known as one of the first scientists in the world to draw attention to climate change. That was in congressional hearings more than 20 years ago. We reached Dr. Hansen in Fort McMurray, Alberta.
Dr. Hansen, why is the head of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies testifying at an environmental assessment hearing for a mining project in Alberta?
Well, the unconventional fossil fuels, of which tar sands is the first big example, are really important because what's become clear is that the conventional oil and gas is enough to take us up to a dangerous level of atmospheric carbon dioxide. So if we're going to solve the climate problem and be fair to young people and future generations, we're going to have to phase out coal emissions over the next couple of decades and avoid the exploitation of these unconventional fossil fuels. Otherwise, we hand a situation to young people which is going to be out of their control.
Do you have concerns about this project over and above others in the oil sands?
Well, you know, the oil sands are really just getting started. And this is the time when people need to recognize what's happening and realize that they look inviting. We need energy, and there's a lot of potential energy in the tar sands, but it's not gold. It's fool's gold, because if we burn those and put the CO2 into the atmosphere, we're going to have to figure out, or our children are going to have to figure out, how to get it back out of there. And the present estimates are it'll cost $200 to $500 per ton of carbon to get it back out of the air. So the bottom line is it doesn't make sense to put it there to begin with. We had better move on to clean energy sources now rather than waiting until we've exploited every last drop of carbon in the ground.
Well, what do you think of Canada's efforts to steward tar sands development? We've had both the federal and provincial governments claiming that the benefits will outweigh the risks.
Yeah, well, it's the same way all around the world. The governments are not doing their job. Neither the executive nor legislative branches of our government in the U.S. or Canada or any other countries. I went to Norway, which I thought was the most environmentally sensitive country, but they also defer to the business interests. Therefore, I think we're going to have to get the judicial branch of the government to intervene. And I think perhaps the most promising approach is to go to the courts, because there is the concept that all people are created equal, and that led in our United States Constitution to the concept of equal protection of the laws, and that's how civil rights were achieved for minorities. Well, we need to get the courts to order the government to give a plan for how it's going to phase down carbon emissions consistent with stabilizing future climate. That's the only way we can solve the problem.
But is there any precedence for this happening anywhere in the world so far?
Well, it's going to be happening pretty soon. There presently is a lot of discussions about this, and I expect that over the next year we're going to begin to see court cases in a number of countries.
You are one of the first people to draw the world's attention to climate change. You talked about this 20 years ago. What do you think of the progress that's been made?
Well, there's been a lot of progress in understanding what's happening. Things have gone right along the path that we expected a couple of decades ago. But the remarkable thing is that there's now this huge gap between what is understood by the relevant scientific community and what is known by the people who need to know, and that's the public. And in large part, this is because of the efforts of the fossil fuel industry to fuel doubt about our understanding of climate change.
You've drawn a lot of criticism for your views, especially from Republican presidents in the U.S. What keeps you going?
Well, my grandchildren are what keeps me going, because I can see what they're going to inherit.
It just seems that no government is willing to force its citizens to compromise their lifestyles. How do we get around that?
Well, the fact is they wouldn't need to compromise their lifestyles. We could move on to clean energies of the future, but there are people who are profiting from the present fossil fuel-based economies, and so they prefer to keep it going that way. But if we would put a gradually rising price on carbon emissions, collecting money from the fossil fuel companies at the domestic mine or port of entry, and distributing that money 100% to the public so that they would have the resources to adjust their lifestyles to cleaner energies, then we could, in fact, have equally good quality of life and move on to the clean energies of the future. But there's just this resistance from the fossil fuel industry.
Do you think the Joslyn North Mine project will be approved?
Well, I hope that it gets delayed to a point where it gives us a chance to make clearer what the total story is, because the scientific story is becoming clearer and clearer each year. And if we can make clear the intergenerational injustice that is involved here, then I think that we can begin to affect policies. So I think even delaying the project is a step in the right direction.
Well, thank you for speaking with us, Dr. Hansen.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
James Hansen is the director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies and is a renowned climate scientist. We reached him in Fort McMurray, Alberta. When the going gets tough in a political campaign, it's not unusual for a politician to go negative. Oh, you know the drill. Pull the skeletons out of the closet, ratchet up the hyperbole, and repeat, repeat, repeat. So on the one hand, there's nothing so unusual about the latest tactic from Ottawa's Larry O'Brien. But the incumbent candidate for mayor of Ottawa has added a new twist to that old routine. Instead of slinging mud at his opponents, Larry O'Brien is smearing himself. Yesterday, Mr. O'Brien told the editorial board of the Ottawa Citizen newspaper that the first 2 years of his mayoral run were, in his words, a direct quote, a complete disaster. And it didn't stop there. For the record, here's Mayor Larry O'Brien speaking yesterday in Ottawa.
I think it confirms something that I've been feeling for a number of weeks, that there's a lot of people out there that voted for me that are quite frankly, they're disappointed in what I did during the first couple of years, and I have to admit that my first 2 years weren't very good. I was a novice. I made a lot of mistakes. I created a lot of my own problems, and started to catch on after I made a significant effort to understand really what this job is. It's a big job, and as I started to become more comfortable with this, quite frankly, biggest job I've ever had in my life, things started to move forward, and I'm hoping I can ask for the support of my, the people who wanted me to succeed 4 years ago, ask them to think about supporting me again. The next 4 years will be the last, won't be like the last 4 years, it'll be like the last year times four.
Another number that stuck out in this poll is 64% wanting a change. Does that...
That's the big number. That's the number that made me realize that people hadn't forgiven me for the first 2 years of being in office, where I, as I euphemistically say, I made just about every mistake possible to make and, as a politician, and a few that were almost impossible to make during the first 18 months to 2 years. Took me a long time. I should have spent more time in the first 4 or 5 months really understanding the totality of the mayor's job. It's a big job, but I'd say I've managed to catch up, and I'm ready to go now.
For the record, that was Mayor Larry O'Brien speaking to reporters in Ottawa yesterday, and time will tell if honesty really is the best policy on this occasion anyway. There are a few clear signs that your election campaign isn't going the way you expected it to. One is that you start your new campaign commercial by saying, "I'm not a witch." That's what Christine O'Donnell has just done. And while you might expect the sentiment to be reassuring, strangely, it's not. Miss O'Donnell is the Republican candidate for the United States Senate in Delaware. And ever since her surprise primary victory on September 14th, which owed much to support from the Tea Party, odd revelations about her past have popped up on an almost daily basis. She was accused of misusing campaign funds for personal use. Her claims that she had studied at Oxford and a California school called Claremont Graduate University have been disputed. And today, tape of a 2006 interview surfaced in which Ms. O'Donnell claimed she had received classified information revealing that China had, as she put it, a strategic plan to take over America. Also, in the mid-90s, as an advocate for sexual abstinence, she rubbed many the wrong way by denouncing solo sexual behavior. And in 1999, on Bill Maher's show Politically Incorrect, she announced that she had, in her words, dabbled into witchcraft. She's keen to dispel that last thing, which explains the new campaign ad. At least that explains her opening line. The rest of the ad is an attempt to establish that Christine O'Donnell is just like you and me. Well, actually, she's just like you, or rather, actually, she is you. I'll let Miss O'Donnell tell you herself. Here's her latest commercial.
I'm not a witch. I'm nothing you've heard. I'm you. None of us are perfect, but none of us can be happy with what we see all around us. Politicians who think spending, trading favors, and backroom deals are the ways to stay in office. I'll go to Washington and do what you'd do. I'm Christine O'Donnell, and I approve this message. I'm you.
That was the latest campaign ad by Christine O'Donnell, the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate in Delaware. Now, I'm no political consultant, but if I were trying to prove that I wasn't a witch, I don't think I would wear a black dress in front of a black background, repeatedly intoning, "I'm you," while staring mesmerizingly into a camera. And if this ad proves to be a sore spot, it's just because it looks unintentionally, I'm sure, like a sorcery spot. Dumb, savage, heartless brutes, also homely, probably rank. It's fair to say that Neanderthals have had a pretty bad rep. But according to new research, we may have unfairly maligned our primitive ancestors. A team of archaeologists from the University of York in England claim they have evidence that shows Neanderthals were, in fact, caring and compassionate individuals. You know, I'm sure they're still probably rank. No one can argue that. Dr. Penny Spikens is the lead researcher behind the report. We reached her at her home in York, England.
Dr. Spikings, just how caring were our Neanderthal cousins?
Well, that's a very interesting question. What we've been doing with our research is we've been setting out to sort of fill in the gap between our knowledge of the level of compassion in our nearest living relatives, chimpanzees, and compassion in our own society. And as we kind of we're all aware, you know, many of us might even go so far as to give our lives for other people that we care about. Whereas what we see in our nearest of living relatives, like chimpanzees, is a kind of very fleeting compassion, an ability to see another individual in distress and hope to alleviate that, to hug someone who's lost a fight, something like that. So what our research has been doing is looking in the archaeological record to trace evidence for compassionate acts, particularly things like caring for someone who's ill or infirm or can't look after themselves, perhaps soothing others' distress. I think we've been surprised, to be honest, by how compassionate people like Neanderthals appear to have been. For example, there's a whole series of records of individuals in Neanderthal times who have been looked after for quite considerable periods of time. There's a man, for example, from Shamazar Cave in Iraq, who had degenerative deformities in both his legs, which is likely to have caused him a painful limp, a withered forearm, which he lost before he died, and he'd received a crushing injury to his cranium, so probably blind in one eye. And many of those injuries seem to have occurred in adolescence, and yet, you know, he's appeared to have been looked after for about 20 to 35 years, probably by the rest of the group. So we're looking at quite an intensive desire to make sure other people are all right within these people.
But how were you able to determine that Neanderthals actually did these things?
Well, if we look at, for example, if we look at skeletal records of individuals who had various kind of traumas, which would mean that they weren't able to look after themselves, and yet these injuries have healed, we can surmise that, you know, other people must have been looking after them, and they must have had a motivation to do so.
How scientific is this? I understand you use a new technique called neuroimaging.
Well, we didn't use neuroimaging, but we use neuroimaging research. So I think what's really happening is that over the past few years, there's been a lot of neuroimaging studies which have shown quite how our own brains work and the way in which compassion works for us. That, you know, when we see someone in distress, that causes us to want to alleviate their pain. And in doing so, we sort of see a release of oxytocin or feel-good hormones. Or we can see the mechanism by which, as a species, we've come to want to help other people. And that provides us with a much better understanding, I think, of how those kind of responses evolved in the past and the kind of mechanisms that we might see that illustrate that in the archaeological record.
And is this evident in those records of Neanderthals?
Well, we think so. What we think is happening is that, I think maybe if you look back, say, 10, 15 years, there wasn't so much evidence for compassion in other animals like chimpanzees or, you know, arguably in animals like elephants or dolphins. So when people look back at the archaeological record, one might see, you know, some evidence for care and think, well, maybe there's another explanation for this. But now that we have a much better understanding that compassion goes back a very long way, at least 6 million years, what we're asking now is not so much, did Neanderthals feel compassion? That seems beyond any reasonable doubt. But what was the structure of their compassion? How did it work in their society? Were they able to make long-term commitments to others, which we think they did? And how might that compare, say, to the way in which compassion works in our society?
Speaking of which, did you learn anything from Neanderthals that might help modern man be more compassionate?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think it's very inspiring, actually, looking at Neanderthals. I think it's quite humbling that people that we think of as or have thought of as primitive can actually care quite deeply for each other. And I think as well we tend, don't we, to put ourselves on a pedestal and look a little bit back on the past and say, oh, look at these primitive people, how much better we are. And I think we learn quite a lot from being a little bit humbled by that and thinking, well, you know, if they were caring deeply for each other and looking after each other, perhaps there's something we could perhaps learn a little bit more from them sometimes.
So what's next for your research?
Well, actually, what we'd like to look at is one of the interesting differences which we find between ourselves and Neanderthals, is we seem to be able to extend, as modern humans, we extend our compassion through things like objects. You know, we might give somebody something. I might, you know, look at a photograph of someone who I know loves me and feel quite comforted by that. And we don't see anything, or we don't think we see much of that in species like Neanderthals. And I think looking a little bit more deeply at how artifacts might work and how they came to be part of our sort of compassionate responses would be a really interesting new area of research.
Well, thank you very much for bringing this to our attention.
Oh, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Dr. Penny Spikens is an archaeologist with the University of York, and we reached her at her home in York, England.
And that brings us gently to the conclusion of the first part of tonight's program, but there's much more to come right after the news. When we return...
paying his debt to society is one thing, but after a disgraced French trader does that, he has to pay a much larger debt to the bank he defrauded.
Led astray, Nigeria struggles to cope with a case of mass lead poisoning that has killed more than 400 children.
Stay tuned. I'm Mary Ambrose.
And I'm Margot Kelly.
Texas as it happens, distributed in the U.S. by Public Radio International. In just a moment, Celeste Headlee with today's takeaway.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is today's takeaway, 5 minutes of the American conversation from WNYC and PRI.
Well, we had a discussion last week, especially about being 26 years old and having a biopic made about you because you've accomplished so much. Most people that responded, including myself, said at 26 years, I really hadn't accomplished all that much. But our next guest is 26 years old, and she could probably have a film made about her. She's the kind of writer who makes others jealous. Fresh out of the Iowa Writers Workshop, but already been chosen twice for the collection of the best American short stories. And there's a great deal of buzz around her first book. It's a collection of 8 short stories. They're kind of longer short stories. And the book's called Before You Suffocate Your Own Fool Self. Danielle Evans joins us here in the studios. You know, it's funny. I was reading an interview of you, and you talked about some of the things that interest you. And I want to list down them because they actually appear in all of your collection of 8 short stories. You said you're interested in what it means to be part of a family, in race, the lived experience of non-whiteness, how women understand and express sexuality and sexual desire, and the thin undercurrent of competition in so many close friendships. Those are all things that emerge in your story collection, and yet you say they come out of the characters and not out of your idea about these things.
Right. Well, I mean, you can't write a story about an idea. You can write an essay about an idea, but if there's no ambiguity and there's no surprise, then there's no story.
So you get interested in characters and you start to write about them.
Mm-hmm.
These are characters you meet on the street?
No, they're the people who live in my head more often than not. I still, in limited portions from family, friends, often though I'll start with a line of dialogue or I'll start with something that could have been really interesting, but because it was real life, somebody was too polite or too reasonable. And I'll think, well, what would have happened if they'd been less polite or less reasonable, or they'd been a different sort of person and that same thing had happened to them.
And yet you must have a crowded population in your head, because in your book you talk about some of them are quite a bit older than you are. One's written in the voice of a guy who's just returned from war. How do you, I mean, do you sit there and just try to empathize, put your people in these shoes? Is that what you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think fiction is an act of intelligent empathy. It's empathy with a sort of broader context.
We're speaking with Danielle Evans. Her new book is called Before You Suffocate Your Own Fool Self. It's a collection of 8 short stories, longer short stories, I should say. And it's gotten amazing reviews. You must be very happy. But I wanted to point to one specifically. This is Washington Post fiction critic Ron Charles.
I don't even know. I mean, should a middle-aged white guy even be reviewing a book by a young African-American? I should have assigned this to an African-American. But isn't that condescending? What, like only black people can understand what black people write? But how do I know what a black person experiences? I don't even think of her as black. What does that even mean? Some of my favorite books are by black people. Oh no, what have I said?
I mean, it's funny, but in the same way, how does it strike you, this kind of angst over how to read your book?
Well, I see it a lot because I also teach African-American literature, and there's always this moment in which, you know, for the first half of the semester, there's this panic because it's like every day you're going to ask me to talk about race in some direct, explicit way or to talk about racism and somehow implicate myself. And then there's a moment when it shifts and when it becomes sort of okay to relate to the characters as characters, to think about the authors as authors, and to have the historical context to understand what's happening on the page without letting that be this purely sociological value for what are often really beautiful books.
But don't you kind of feel like it's a little different with authors of a different race? In other words, we don't sit there and read Dickens and think, I can't read this as an American, you know, 40-year-old woman. I can't even relate to what it was like to be an orphan in London. And, you know, I mean, isn't there kind of a different set of standards around race?
Yeah, and I had to, I mean, as a teacher, I had to step away from my own experiences reading because I never expected to see myself on the page, right? I mean, most of my experience of literature, I didn't read a book about anybody who was remotely like me until I got to college, and that was because I sought it out. Like, I could have gotten through college without doing that too. So my relationship to the page was always about sort of submerging myself in someone else's experience and learning to empathize with people who might not only be unlike me, but be actively hostile to me.
Which is interesting because Daniel Evans is who we're speaking to right now, and you've listed The Great Gatsby and The Prayer for Owen Meany as two big influences on you, clearly not written by young African-American women.
Yeah, but I was actually just talking to somebody about the ways in which Don Irving and Toni Morrison are doing really similar structural things, and he was the first person I ever heard say that besides myself.
It's called Before You Suffocate Your Own Full Self, and I guarantee you all the people in it are interesting. Daniel Evans, thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Celeste Headlee. For more of The Takeaway, visit us online at thetakeaway.org. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
Hello again, I'm Margot Kelly.
And I'm Mary Ambrose. This is As It Happens, Part 2. Coming up.
In Toronto, protesters argue that a court decision meant to protect sex trade workers will actually have the opposite effect.
And disgusted by a theme park attraction featuring evil clowns, British clowns urge park officials to walk a mile in their hilariously oversized shoes.
Those stories are still to come on As It Happens.
Described as a soft-spoken, shy Frenchman from Western Brittany. He's also the former futures index trader behind history's biggest trading scandal. Today, 33-year-old Jérôme Carvial was found guilty of defrauding the bank Société Générale for 4.9 billion euros, and that's just shy of, $7 billion Canadian, or the equivalent of the gross domestic product of Monaco. For his crimes, Mr. Carvial will spend the next 3 years in jail, and when that's done, the harshest and most surprising part of his sentence begins. Today, the judge ordered him to pay back all the money to the bank. Nicolas Barré has been following this story. He is the deputy managing editor at Le Figaro newspaper, and we reached him in Paris.
Mr. Barré, Jérôme Carvial was convicted of all the charges against him, but he only pleaded guilty to unauthorized use of a computer, denying the other two charges, including fraud. Why was that?
Well, basically, he was saying that people in the bank, and especially those directly in charge of supervising trading, knew about his trades, and that he didn't do anything wrong in this respect. But, of course, during the trial and even before that, it was established that Carvial actually dodged all the controls and knew how to get into the system and knew how to make fake trades, so to speak. So it appeared during the trial that all his defense was based on falsifications and so on.
So in the end, does it seem that his bosses had no idea what he was up to, putting billions upon billions of dollars at risk? I mean, way more than the actual market value of the bank itself.
Well, actually, the bank recognized that their controls obviously were not appropriate, to say the least. And in fact, they have been accused and condemned for that before. And since then, the bank has been ordered by the regulators here to restructure their all internal systems. They have also fired the people who were in charge of the supervision inside the bank. So obviously there was something that was going wrong and that was really, really wrong inside the bank. But it appears that even if the bank was responsible for not having put in place the right controls, this rogue trader was still accused and convicted for a massive fraud.
But specifically, how was he able to pull this off? What did he do?
What he did was basically make fake trades in front of real ones. On one hand, he would buy or sell securities on the market, and then on the other hand, he would have another trade that was supposed to cancel or be in front of these real trades, but in fact there was no other transaction in to compensate the real trades that he was making. So the bank discovered, but after a long time, and that's the problem, but the bank discovered that he had put at risk billions of euros. At one point, he was able to bet almost twice the capital of the bank.
Yeah. Over what period of time are we talking about?
Between two or three years.
And now during the trial, his lawyers were arguing that this is really about a corrupt banking system, simply not the work of a lone trader. Is there the sense publicly that this stand has any credibility?
It's interesting because initially, of course, when this whole scandal was discovered 3 years ago, the first reaction of the French public was that the bank had identified a poor guy it appeared that it was impossible that this guy had done all this alone and without any people helping him or without his bosses being aware of what was going on. But today, the image of Kerviel has deteriorated, and it appears today that, he was just a guy who did a massive fraud like Nick Leeson several years ago at Behrings, for instance.
Now, he's been ordered to pay back 4.9
yes.
billion euros. Is there any realistic expectation that much of this will ever be recovered?
No, absolutely not. And by the way, the bank has said that they would not try to recover the money. They wanted him to be convicted. They wanted the judges put this figure for reasons of principle. They wanted to be able to go to the public and say, look, we have a decision from the justice that says that we have lost 4.9 billion euros because of this guy who is guilty of a massive fraud. But the bank is realistic, and they know that there is absolutely no chance that Kerviel could pay even a very small amount of money. I mean, he will go to jail for at least 3 years. And after that, it's going to be difficult for him to rebuild his life. But today, with this decision and with this huge and absurd amount of money that he is asked to repay, for the first time in a long time, he appears again as a victim. The reactions tonight here in Paris were, well, it's nonsense. I mean, of course he's guilty. Of course he did something wrong. But asking him to repay almost 4 billion euros is just ridiculous. And so many people feel some sympathy, at least for this guy, even though it's obvious for everybody now that he did something really wrong and he will go to jail for that.
Well, Mr. Barret, thank you so much for telling us about this.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Nicolas Barret is the deputy manager editor of Le Figaro. He was in Paris. Jonathan Franzen has performed three magic tricks of late. First, he published a book that has been breathlessly called a masterpiece and is also a number one bestseller. Second, he's made 80,000 copies of that book, Freedom, disappear. And third, he turned two spectacles into one spectacle. So we told you last week about the second thing, when HarperCollins UK printed the wrong draft of his new bestseller, Freedom, and was forced to ask those who bought those misprints to return them for pulping. And today we'll tell you about the third thing, a story involving stolen glasses, a ransom note, and a helicopter chase. To find out more about the author's curious trip to London, we reached Graham Neal. He's the news editor of the magazine The Bookseller, and we reached him in London.
Mr. Neal, what exactly happened at last night's book launch?
Well, from what I understand, two men get across the party. They apparently said that they worked for a children's publisher. they both approached Franson, and one of the guys basically just seized the glasses from Franson's face and ran off into Kensington Gardens. The other man, he handed Jonathan a note, which was a ransom letter asking for $100,000 for the safe return of the glasses, and there was an email address included as well. And he also legged it into the night. And at that point, I think it was one of HarperCollins' sales team, followed in pursuit.
So the two guys take off, and then I understand there was a helicopter chase?
Yes, I think that's probably a fair way to describe it. What had happened was that the two men, they swam across the Serpentine Lake, which, you know, is in the middle of Kensington Gardens. And at that point, a police helicopter was called and used infrared scanning, I think, to actually try and track down the two guys. I know that one of them, the guy who'd actually stolen the glasses, he was found hiding in the bushes, probably very, very wet indeed. And it was at that point he was arrested, and the glasses were returned back to Franson.
Do you know anything about these two men?
I don't. There were suggestions that it was some sort of performance art experiment, but I would have thought that they would have made public who they were and what they were doing by now. I mean, it's been quite a, I think, eventful is probably an understatement, week for Franson. There was the issue last week with the errors being discovered in his book, and HarperCollins, his publisher, having to reprint Freedom very, very quickly. And he was due to do a radio interview with the BBC yesterday, and his car failed to show up, and there were tube strikes all across London yesterday. So he ended up being half an hour late to quite a big interview for him. So, I mean, it got to the point last night where he just thought, what else could possibly go wrong for him?
Absolutely. I mean, he's been on the cover of Time magazine. He's had this problem with the wrong draft of his book being printed,
yeah.
And now his glasses taken. What is this like for his publisher?
I think, initially just mortified. I mean, the tone of the event last night before Glassesgate, as some people seem to dub it, happened was they were very apologetic about the mistakes that were made last week. I mean, it's been years since an author was on the cover of Time. I mean, Freedom is, you know, one of the most sought after, you know, literary fiction novels of this year. Victoria Barnsley, who runs HarperCollins, she described it as the novel of the decade, which is quite a brave sticking your neck out in, the first year of a new decade, really. And I think that whenever the glasses were stolen, they were just utterly gobsmacked by this, really, because it was so unexpected, and it was just, I mean, you did feel sorry for them, you know, because they were probably thinking, you know, what else can happen now?
Well, a helicopter chase, that seems
it's
such an extreme reaction for a pair of glasses.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the circumstances as to when and how the police were called. I mean, that would be a question, really, for the Metropolitan Police in London. I mean, there were suggestions that because they were fleeing across the Serpentine Lake, it was an issue of safety.
And what about Jonathan Franson himself? What is he saying about all of this?
Well, he didn't press charges, which was probably shows his frame of mind. I mean, I saw him after. I mean, he looked, it was sort of a mixture of shocked and, I mean, incredulous. I mean, who expects something like that to happen, particularly at a large event for your own book? But it wasn't as if he threw the head up, stormed out of the event. I mean, he was talking to people. You know, a lot of people were basically, you know, going over to him and extending their maybe sympathies as being a bit too strong, but definitely commiserating with him that something so utterly bizarre had just happened to him.
Well, it's certainly going to bring him a lot more attention than he already has.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a massively hyped book anyway. I mean, the hype over the past couple of weeks in the UK has been tremendous for it, and I think it's probably not the publicity campaign that HarperCollins envisaged, but it's definitely kept them in the headlines for the best part of a week.
Well, thank you very much for telling us about it.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Graham Neal is the editor of the trade magazine, The Bookseller. Last night, he attended a book launch during which best-selling author Jonathan Franzen's glasses were kidnapped for ransom. Uneasy lies the head that wears a clown nose, in Staffordshire, England, anyway. The Alton Towers amusement park there was the site of a protest by professional clowns who were not amused by a new attraction that they feel cast them in a bad light. Jan Erik Brenner, better known as Phipps the Clown, took part in the demonstration, and he spoke to us just after finishing a show in Coventry, England.
Hello, Mr. Brenner.
Hello there.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I've literally just finished a performance and I've sat down to relax.
Good. Are you in your costume or out of your costume?
I actually have my clown socks on and my makeup, but my normal clothes.
Good, good. Okay. Mr. Brenner, what is it about this ride, the Carnival of Screams, that has you and your clown colleagues so upset?
The whole way they want to portray clowns as evil and the way they're advertising it as evil clowns. Come along and be scared by the evil clowns. We're not evil and we hate to be portrayed as evil. You know, young minds are so impressionable. If you keep hearing those two words together, evil and clowns, children then come onto a conclusion, just based on what they heard, and adults alike, that clowns are evil. And to be honest, I don't see what clowns have to do with Halloween. They want a Halloween attraction, Alton Towers, so why not have witches, ghosts, pumpkins? I don't really see the need for clowns. It's called the Carnival of Screams Fun House. It's a fun house. So if they want a fun house, put jolly clowns in there. Funny clowns, happy clowns. Just don't promote evil clowns.
But obviously being scared by clowns represents some kind of an attraction. Otherwise, Alton Towers wouldn't be offering it as part of his thrill ride. Why do you think some people find them creepy and clearly enjoy being scared by them?
I think this is a minority, to be honest. I mean, there is a recognized phobia of clowns. But I think it is a very small minority that are actually genuinely scared of clowns. A lot of people are going to take it in good humour, and that's I suppose that's what Alton Towers, you know, wanted. But the thing is I'm scared of is the fact, and my colleagues, the fact that they keep portraying clowns as evil, and they're using the whole thing, evil clowns. To be honest, this could do for clowns what Jaws did for sharks.
Oh, dear. But, you know, we are seeing the scary clown becoming a staple of horror stories and fairground attractions as popular culture.
Yeah, through the media and through films and that. I mean, ever since Stephen King's It, there's a whole generation after that, after the book and the film, that grew up based on what they'd seen in that movie, decided they do not like clowns. Because it's not a case of people being scared of evil clowns. It's a case because they then become, or think they are, scared of all clowns because they presume that all clowns are evil.
Now, Alton Towers, I understand, maintains that the ride is not for children. So what's wrong with it as long as there are no kids on the ride?
Why are they using clowns? It's not for children. Why use clowns? If it's, you know, based for adults, obviously they could. I think they could come up with something better to scare adults with than clowns. Why not bank managers? My bank manager scares me.
So you're
income tax man.
Well, speaking of the bank, I guess you must be concerned that a ride like this is going to have an impact on your business.
It does. It does. It definitely does. Because what happens is we're in the entertainment industry, you know, and we're jolly, we're funny. But if somebody gets into their mind that clowns are evil, it might not be today, it might not be tomorrow, but it might be at the next birthday. They say, how about we get you a clown for your birthday? Oh, no, I won't. No, no. Because in the back of their mind, they've got that. The clowns are evil. And it's just not so.
So you had a protest today. Do you think it's going to change anybody's mind?
I would like to think so. The next course of action, we want to start a Facebook page and get people's feedback on what they actually think. Alden Towers let us protest for about 2 hours, and then, to be honest, they had to come and move us along. As you can imagine, you get 10 clowns together, it does get rather noisy. So after about 2 hours, they did come and move us along, which I had just enough time to put a custard pie in one of the security men's face.
How did that go over?
Oh, he loved it.
So
it was done by a funny clown. So obviously it was funny.
So you're this is going to kick off on Halloween. This ride. Are you planning any further protests?
At the moment, we're thinking about going and actually locking the gates, but we've got to look into that one, because we don't want to cause trouble. We just want to create awareness that clowns aren't evil, and we don't want to be portrayed as evil. So we have to tread carefully. I think initially we've started now in the right way. Everyone stood up and paid attention. We're not going to sit here quietly. We want our voice to be heard.
Well, Mr. Brenner, we wish you luck with your clown crusade.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Jan Eric Brenner performs as Phipps the Clown, and we spoke to him from Coventry, England. Well, rest easy, Phipps. There are no scary clowns lurking in the dark in this next tune. Here's Ron Sexsmith with Clown in Broad Daylight. From his 1997 album Other Songs, Ron Sexsmith with Clown in Broad Daylight.
I'm Carol Off. As it happens, is distributed in the U.S. by PRI, Public Radio International. We'll be right back.
from coast to coast, this is CBC Radio.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for WAMC comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a 15-credit certificate in not-for-profit management, available alone or as part of the MBA Plus. 518-454-5143. And David Stein, DDS, Union Avenue, Schenectady, featuring new dental technology, including implants, computer-aided local anesthesia, digital x-rays, and VelScope oral cancer screening. DavidSteinDDS.com.
This is Northeast Public Radio, WAMC FM 90.3 Albany,